This is Keeping It 101, a Killjoy's Introduction to Religion podcast. I am Megan Goodwin, a scholar of race, religion, American politics. I am not Elise Morgenstein First. Neither am I a scholar of South Asia or imperialism, although I do play one on television. Hi, this is our very first live podcast recording. We are so grateful for all the awesome folks at Miami University in Ohio for having us out to talk to them about calendars and how race and religion take up your time and what they're doing with them. Spoilers, we say white supremacy a lot. Sounds a little crunchy because it was live and it's our first time, but we think it's pretty listenable. We are excited to share this with you. We'll be back to regularly scheduled programming as soon as we can get our lives together. We miss y'all too. Stay tuned. And thanks again to Miami University, Ohio.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here today. Hello. Hi, friends. Hi. Yes. Nope. That's good. That's I should have said hello to you first and then turned. My job is to do a bit of a preamble. First, I guess we should observe that we're observing the Midwestern season of tornadoes. Mm. And if a siren goes off, I think our best option is to exit this door, go downstairs, and circle around. There's kind of an alcove where we can take cover. But let's hope that does not occur. I'm Nathan French. I'm an associate professor of comparative religion here at Miami. It's good to see a few of my students here in the crowd. It's good to see the whole crowd here, actually. And I'm beginning with a bit of a preamble that we think is incredibly important as a department and as an institution. Charles Long, the historian of religions at the University of Chicago, once defined religion as a matter of orientation. And he was echoing in this the Protestant theologian Paul Tillich from the University of Chicago, meaning one's ultimate orientation to life. Probably one of the simplest definitions of religion we get, religion being ultimate concern. But he also defined it as orientation in the world. And today's lecture by title and by content promises to give us some sort of orientation in time. We will see.
Let's find out.
It is my task to orient us in place. We stand here now upon sacred ground. But as any good scholar of religion will tell you, we must consider upon whose sacred ground we stand. Walter Havinghurst, a professor of English at Miami University, who worked variously as a critic, novelist, literary, and social historian of the Midwest, and occasionally would sometimes add folklorist, wrote in his history of this institution, the Miami Years, that, quote, during the summer of 1812, axes were thudding in the college forest. The Indian mound on the site of present Stoddard Hall, which is about 750 feet from here, was leveled, and 2 acres were cleared for a university campus. John Bigger, who died in 1840, who sat at the head of Miami's first board of trustees, was, Havinghurst said, a settler of the, quote, wild lands in Warren County, Ohio. The board's secretary was James McBride, a 23-year-old with experience measuring indigenous mounds and earthworks in this region. Benjamin Whiteman, another board member, brought violence against the Shawnee peoples to clear them off of this land. T.H. Morris, Havinghurst wrote, was, quote, one of the first white men ever to see the dark woods and bright prairies of Western Ohio. John Riley, another board member, when asked of his career, simply listed fighter. These men saw this land as part of a conquest and civilizational expansion in the service of U.S. higher education. But the sacrality of this place exceeded vastly their work. This was sacred land long before an axe was taken to a tree on these lands where we sit by these men. And so we turn then, importantly, to our university's land acknowledgement. Miami University is located within the traditional homelands of the Miamia and Shawnee people, who along with other indigenous groups ceded these lands to the United States in the first Treaty of Greenville in 1795. The Miami people, whose name this university carries, were forcibly removed from these homelands in 1846. In 1972, a relationship between Miami University and the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma began and evolved into a reciprocal partnership, including the creation of the Miamia Center at Miami University in 2001. The work of the Miamia Center serves the Miami Tribe community and is dedicated to the revitalization of Miami language and culture and to restoring that knowledge to the Miamia people. Miami University and the Miami Tribe are proud of this work and of the more than 140 Miamia students who have attended Miami since 1991 through the Miamia Heritage Award program. Thanks.
It was nice. Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you, Nathan. Welcome, everybody. Welcome this afternoon. I am Liz Wilson, and I'm a professor of comparative religion, and it is my great pleasure to introduce our two guests today, brought to you by the Arthur C. Wickenden Lecture Fund and the co-sponsors listed here, the Miami Alumni Association, the Harry Wilkes Mehta Collective, the Menard Family Center for Democracy, and the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies. So our guests here are the hosts of an amazing religious studies podcast, as you can see the title, Keeping It 101, A Killjoy's Introduction to Religion. They started this podcast in 2020 and it very quickly gained a national audience. And it has won funding that has gotten it through the pandemic, and it has become must-listen-to material for me and for many of my colleagues. What we're doing here today is a pretty amazing thing of recording an episode of the podcast. So I'm excited to get started with the podcast itself. I'd like to introduce our guests. We have on the right Dr. Megan
Goodwin,
excuse me, Dr. Megan Goodwin, a scholar of American religion. She is media and tech consultant on the Crossroads Project, and she is author of a book, Abusing Religion, Literary Persecution, Sex Scandals, and American Minority Religions. Dr. Goodwin is currently editing a book that the two podcast hosts have co-written. It's called Religion Is Not Done With You, and will be coming out this year with Beacon Press. On your left is Dr. Elise Morgenstein First. She's a scholar of Islam in South Asia, of race, racialization, imperialism, and history of ideas in the study of religion. She's associate professor of religion at University of Vermont, where she directs the Humanities Center. I'll mention a couple of Dr. Morgenstein First's books. She's author of Indian Muslim Minorities and the 1857 Rebellion, co-editor of Words of Experience, and she has a second monograph on the way called Imperial Pandemics. So we have an exciting podcast ahead of us. The way it's going to work is that the host will speak for about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll have Q&A. Dr. John Charles Duffy and myself will be roving with microphones, so bring your questions and bring your curiosity. Is there anything else I need to say before we get started?
I think that'll do it.
All right. Awesome.
Thanks, Liz. Hit it.
Well, this is Keeping It 101 and Killjoy's Introduction to Religion. As of 2023, we're proud to be part of the Amplify podcast network. And we're grateful to record and present today on the current and ancestral lands of the Miamia and the Shawnee. As always, you can find material ways to support Indigenous communities, which is the important part of a land acknowledgement, on our website.
What's up, nerds?
Thank you.
Hi, hello. I'm Megan Goodwin, a scholar of American religions, race, gender, sexuality, and politics.
Hi, hello. I'm Elise Morgenstein First, a historian of religion, Islam, race and racialization, and South Asia.
Yeah. I feel like there's something different about the show today.
What makes you say that?
I don't know. Vibes. and maybe all of these people staring at us while we do a thing that we usually keep to our small private closets.
Yeah, I record this podcast from the laundry room in my house. This is definitely different.
This, yeah, it feels different.
For the first time in history, Keeping It 101 is live and in person. That's right, nerds. That's you. You are witnessing, is that a thing you can do through an audio medium?
Unquip.
Okay. Let's find out. Well, you are witnessing the making of the podcast in real time. We're so happy to be here with all of the awesome folks at Miami University.
Yay!
Thank you. We love when we do our own soundboard mixing in real time.
Really
and we
want to
start off our first ever live recording with a huge, big, enormous thank you to Liz Wilson, John Charles Duffy, Erica Keener, Hannah Muldoon Davis, JJ Slager, and everybody else who made it possible for us to be here today.
Thanks to all of these awesome folks, and double thanks to all the nerds who showed up to hear us yell about...
Calendars. We're yelling about calendars.
Calendars. I thought this was a podcast about religion. The fuck.
I know that you're setting me up for one of my favorite all-time rants, but I'm going to play along. I'm going to pretend like I didn't write this entire script and just play along. Oh, those were your skeptical noises.
Well, no, you didn't say yes calendars yet.
Yes to calendars.
Skeptical noises.
All right, fine. I'll prove it to you. Nerds in the audience, you can play too if you want, and I encourage you to. Goodwin, where is your phone?
In my pocket, sis. Of course.
Great. Take it out. If you've got a phone, wave it around. Feel its presence in your body. Congratulations. You have found religion in your pants or pockets.
I have a list of jokes that I'm not supposed to make here. One, wouldn't be the first time. Two, man, if I had a nickel. Three, checks out, I did go to a lot of Catholic school.
Dude, we said not to say these jokes.
Too late. Four, you promised you'd stop making fun of me for dating that unfunny pastor that one time. We talked about this.
Okay, but seriously, and off of that scenario that is not for undergraduates at Miami University, your phone most certainly has a calendar on it. And religion is all over our calendars, as any of you, we hope, or any of our regular listeners would know by now, because I talk about this a lot. Race is all over those calendars, too, as it turns out.
Okay, no, but seriously, though, you're... Okay, I acknowledge that it is very hard to get your calendar not to tell you when Christmas is. It's even harder to, like, cash a check or mail a package on the 25th of December. What does race have to do with any of this?
I mean, literally everything. Banter is good, but people are watching us, and I can't take a pause. So why don't we do this in a faster way? Okay. Calendars, we argue, is a good place to think about how race and religion shape our experience of the world. Our calendars are a particularly clear example of how a seemingly neutral and apolitical tool actually smuggle all sorts of... gasp, white Christian privilege and dominance into our everyday lives. Gasp.
Really killing the Foley work up here. Okay, I know you could, and quite frankly, have, I love you, never change, talk about this for literal hours on end, but eventually we do have to let folks in the audience ask questions. Also, can I say for the record that I'm really annoyed that we didn't think to call this episode Time Bandits? I'm really upset about that. As a joke for people my age. Thank you. It's a good movie. Anyway, how about we focus on three key points in segments I have entitled, number one, Religion is Racialized, in which we tell you how religion and race shape and make and remake each other. Number two, the year of someone's Lord. You have to hear Lord in all capital letters. In which we grump about the fact that different folks in different places measure time differently, which matters. And yet the whole world has to accommodate, for example, the imaginary birthday of an 8-pound, 6-ounce tiny baby Jesus in a global marketplace. Because empire. Number three, calendars, in which we show you that no matter how you feel about religion, your calendar is doing medium to high-key white Christian supremacies every freaking week of every freaking year.
Yeah, and then because we're trying to be... you know, constructive, we can finish by making some suggestions about what our nerds and dear students in the audience here and at home in their cars and their kitchens and folding laundry, because this will eventually be broadcast, can do to push back against the privilege lurking in their calendars. Does that sound good?
Does that sound good?
Try that again.
You're all stuck here, so let's get into it. Yeah, it sounds great. I can feel the enthusiasm. Yes, good, great. Let's do it. Segment one.
Religion is racialized.
Oh, hey, that's us. One more.
Thanks, JJ.
Okay, first and forevermore, we need to talk about how religion is racialized, because believe it or not, calendars, which I know you're so excited to talk about. I promise we're getting there. I promise. Calendars are just lousy with race, religion, and empire. That's a lot.
It really is. So I take it what we're going to do is break down that messy lot into manageable bites for our delightful audience.
So delightful. Yes, please, and thank you. Let's do it.
All right. Well, Goodwin, why don't you get us going then? What do we mean when we say religion is racialized? What does that actually mean?
Okay. So, love a definition. Religion is a thing that people do, and as scholars of religion, we look for it and use, frankly, too many years of schooling to try and make sense of it. One of the things that we say most often on this here pod is religion is not done with you. That is, even if you yourself are not religious, even if you do not give a care about religion, religion is still shaping the world all around you, including, you guessed it, on your calendars. Religion plays and has played an important role in the making of race and vice versa. So we cannot actually think about religion without thinking about race. And we cannot properly understand race without thinking about religion. Both race and religion are meanings made by people about people. We call those social constructs.
Okay, so what I hear you saying is that race is a social construct.
Yes.
And in the U.S., we over-identify race with color, but that's not nearly all of it. What does racialization mean, Dr. Goodwin?
I love it when you let me talk theory to you, Dr. Morgenstein first. Very well, I accept. Racialization is a fancy grad school way of talking about the making of race. So once more, racialization equals race making. It's how we make race. When we're talking about race being made, we're acknowledging that humans make meaning of our bodies and of the bodies of others. We do this to create and maintain social order. Making meaning on bodies to create and maintain social order, that's social construction. As humans, we assign the cluster of qualities that make up race. So physical characteristics like skin color, sure, but also behaviors and linguistics and food ways and geographies and kinship structures, ways of knowing histories, art, so much more. We assign all of those quality meaning, or all of those qualities meaning, and importantly, we take the vast differences and diversity of huge groups of people who share some but not all of these characteristics and collapse them into singular identities, which we call race. Racialization, the making of race, is the process through which individuals, groups, and as we'll see, ideas like religion, are identified as or with one particular set of characteristics. And also as one group, as one race. Racialization is an ongoing process, so it can and does move and change over time. But it's important to remember that racialization, like all social constructs, doesn't just happen to like list flavors of humans. It is a system, it's not Baskin-Robbins. It is a system that functions to create and preserve power and inequalities. And in the United States, race functions to uphold white supremacy. The valuation of qualities we associate with whiteness over all other racial expressions.
Yeah, and the clearest example to me of this process is the racialization of terrorists as Muslims, and specifically what sociologist Nadine Naber calls the Arab/Muslim/Middle Eastern matrix. Before 9/11, there were ways we talked about Muslims as violent and disloyal and sometimes as terrorists. But after 9/11, we see a shift where almost no one except Muslims can be affiliated with terrorists or terrorism. The affiliation of all Muslims in all times, in all places, in all regions of the world with these two terms, terrorist or terrorism, then is a tying of Islam, this global religion, to a particular region, skin color, clothing type, ethnicity, is part of this racialization process.
Yeah, all of that. And obviously, religious racialization isn't unique to Muslims. Nowhere in the world do religion and race exist separately from one another. Jews are racialized as Jews, regardless of skin color, as not exactly white and emphatically not Christian. And in the US, religion literally and directly constructs our understanding of whiteness, as well as blackness and nativeness. We did a whole episode on this, in fact.
We did. So religion being racialized basically means that we cannot think about and should not talk about religion without also talking about race. Is that what we're saying?
That is what we're saying, yes, yes. And I'm going to say it again. Social constructs like race aren't just about identifying categories of human difference. Social constructs are violence. They are about sorting different humans into different groups to maintain power. We call this racism, and in the US, racism most clearly manifests as white supremacy. But also, violence is not all racialization is. Racialized communities also find joy and creativity and energy and liberation within themselves and their sense of connection to one another. Race, like religion, is complicated and multiple.
Okay, so we can't think about religion without thinking about race, because around the world, and especially in the US, we make those two categories simultaneously, building off of one another. We could and have talked about this in other places, but I thought we were here to talk about calendars.
We are. I promised you calendars. I promised. Okay. But we said up top that race is part of everything? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Everything.
All right. Like, I know race is complicated. I sure made it complicated enough, like, a minute ago. But what does race have to do with time? Isn't time just, like, I don't know, fucking counting?
It's empire, Megan.
Oh.
So let's get into it with segment two, the year of somebody's lord. Megan, is this going to be, like, a short little section?
Why would it be a short section?
Because we literally live in the year, for me personally, of someone else's lord. That's it. That's the section. We're in Jesus plus one.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Good talk. Wait, no. Okay. Several many people showed up to hear us explain ourselves. People, would you like to know more things? Great. At least three people want to know more things. Great.
Great.
Appreciate you.
Those three.
Front row.
Good work, faculty nerds. Yeah. All right, Megan, we can expand. I will expand. 2024 is how many years since Jesus, someone else's Lord, was born?
Plus
maybe your Lord, but not mine. And the only reason we all have to live under that time regime is because of Christian imperialism. It's forced under the notion that none of the rest of us, have calendars worth exploring, and that our calendars are particular, whereas the year of someone else's lord is universal, globally applicable.
Okay, now you're just being hostile. Which...
me?
It's a look. I mean, it's how you look. Is it a good look?
I mean, it is my look, and that's all that matters, and I get to pick my nail color and my lip color, and I pick this too. I'm mostly joking, but we cannot deny that we live in a global hegemony of time that prioritizes and enshrines the year of someone else's lord. And I'm doing that on purpose. I want you to hear how uncomfortable that is. If that feels bad to you, if you want to say the year of my lord, great, not mine. I want you to feel a little itchy with that. So if we live in a global hegemony of time that prioritizes and enshrines the year of someone else's lord above all other modalities of time, and that system develops in the midst of colonial modernity, a time period that starts roughly after 1492 when Columbus famously went looking for India across the ocean blue and got super lost and did all manner of horrific violence in the name of Christianity, civilization, and money. Those things are not separable.
Okay, I cannot believe I'm going to say this, but you just did all that history very, very fast.
Uh-huh.
If you are not listeners of the podcast, the gag there is that I usually have 15 ideas in one sentence, and Elise yells at me about it all the time.
Uh-huh.
But she actually just condensed, what, like 800 years of history into three sentences. So I am going to encourage us, novelty, to slow down a little bit.
What?
We very sincerely hope that these fine folks at Miami University did not think that all people in all times and all places, including our own, measured time as time elapsed since Jesus, and any time before that as counting down to Jesus. Not once did Julia say, "Hey, Brutus, is it 50 years till Christ or 49? Not once did Brutus reply, "It sure is weird that we experience time forward, but we're counting it backward to some point that will be recognized later." And sure, the more conscientious among us might write CE, that is Common Era, rather than AD, Anno Domini, i.e. the year of the Christian Lord, whose devotees colonized nearly all the countries in all the world. But our globally standard dates are still Jesus plus N, no matter how you suffix them.
Okay, so to sum up, it is 2024 for Christians, since that is the number of years Christians agree since Jesus, their literal God, was born, and the rest of us call that the Common Era because of Pope Gregory making it standard just as imperial expansion happened, which is to say that the whole world talks about February and November in 2024 on a standard calendar is inherently and purposefully, and without argument actually, Christian imperialism, despite nearly all of the other communities having their own months, years, and systems. Do you see why that makes me grumpy?
I do. I like you, Grumpy. And I think what I hear you saying is that empire is at work here because as white Christian imperial expansion happened, so did the need for a standardized calendar. And Pope Gregory XIII in 1582, look at me doing a history, before the 1980s even. Yeah.
Shocking.
I know. He issued a papal bull, which is basically a decree, that standardized time. He's just like, guess what, world? We're all counting the same way now. And yeah, it took a little while for it to become standard across all places, but that little while more or less coincides with patterns of white European colonization. In other words, we would not and could not have a standard calendar based solely on Christianity if it wasn't for the premise, advent, and violent success of white Christian imperialism.
Look, there's so much to say about white Christian imperialism, and we keep using that phrase, white Christian imperialism, because it is the matrix of power that exists. It's not just imperialism. Loads of places did imperialism. It's not just European or later American, because there's lots of different examples of European and American forms of power.
Sure,
and it's not
just
white. It's the whole thing together with its litany of assumptions about the rest of the world. And what are those assumptions? Lacking civilization, heathen, too emotional, too sexual, too stupid, too violent, too effeminate, too everything that wasn't the norm at the moment. And this is where racialization comes in. It's not that white Christian imperialists did not know about other people's religions or calendars. It's that they did and deemed them inferior, evidence of why they deserved forcible conversion, persecution, enslavement, the stripping of their land, and in many cases, in many more cases than actually we have time to name, genocide.
So what we're saying, essentially, is that how we measure time is intrinsically linked to empire. Once more with feeling. How we measure time all over the world, regardless of our religious background, directly linked to white, Western, European, Christian imperialism. And empire itself is intrinsically linked to religious racialization. So calendars, friends, are also about race, religion, and empire. Ta-da.
All right, Goodwin. Let's move on. I'm ready to leave this section. I wanted it to be 3 seconds. It was many more seconds. So, segment three, calendars equal race plus religion plus empire, which is just math.
Okay. Outshola that section. Let's talk. It's fine. It's funny. Two people. Let's talk about the real world. Dr. Morgenstein first asked us to find religion in our pockets at the top, and we're going to land the plane there, too. Y'all get your phones ready? Yeah, we're doing an applied learning. Get your phones out. Great. Okay. The standard calendar preloaded into smartphones is the Christian calendar. The year the world agrees on, or better put, the year that white Christian imperialists imposed upon the globe is a year that literally honors how many years have passed since the birth of Jesus Christ. Plus or minus 5 years, actually, they shifted a little bit. Jesus, who is a famously not Hindu, not Muslim, not Buddhist, and shockingly born Jewish but non-Jewish figure slash God. This means that the red number dates on your calendar app may vary by country, but in multicultural, multi-religious North America and Europe, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, and Native or Indigenous holidays are never standard. You want those? You need a plug-in or a subscription or maybe like an in-app purchase. Those religions are extra. They're like bonus religions, add-ons. They're not normal. They're not expected. They're not standard. Because in a chronological system based on how many years have passed since Jesus was born, Jesus' birthday is on all your calendars. Jesus' birthday is given.
So what? Can't we just like get that plug-in? What's so hard about that?
Sure, capitalism is the answer to everything. You're right. Why didn't I think of that? No, you can, obviously, but that's not helping you be a better neighbor or colleague or citizen or educated person. Like, what would Mr. Rogers say? Come on, man. Also, this isn't us just being nitpicky nerds. It is also that. We are always that, but it's not just that. Google's calendar app is the standard smartphone calendar. It's been downloaded 500 million times.
One in three people who use a calendar app anywhere in the world are using this Jesus Plus, whatever year it is, calendar. This calendar is making religious and political choices about who counts enough to make the standard cut and who's too far outside white Western Christianity flavored time-telling to have real, and for listeners at home, please hear those scare quotes, real holidays. All calendars make these kind of religio-political choices, and calendars show us religious history, but also religious inclusion and exclusion at work in our daily lives.
Calendars aren't just years, though, and different religious communities measure time differently, too. Why does a standard day run midnight to midnight instead of, as in Jewish practice, more or less, roughly sunset to sunset? Different calendars also show us different communities' ways of marking seasons. The Jewish New Year, or Rosh Hashanah, is in the fall, corresponding to harvest seasons. The Persian New Year, Nowruz, is in spring, corresponding to when the world, like, wakes back up. And even though for a majority of Persian folk are also Muslim, Nowruz is not the Islamic New Year, which is typically observed on the first Islamic month of Muharram. Across Asia and in many different religions, Lunar New Year happens between the end of January and the end of February because it's based on a lunisolar calendar. And if that word doesn't make sense to you, we can talk more about that later.
Moon plus sun. Done.
Time is, in short, complicated, and the way we measure time is all tangled up in religion, which means that a standard or a secular calendar ignores Jewish, Persian, Hindu, Buddhist, lunar, Islamic, etc. calendars. It cannot be primary in that system. It can only be secondary. And all that second-class stuff is about whiteness and Christianity and whose systems are allowed privilege, priority, and dominance.
Because no matter where you are, whose holidays are recognized by the state, schools, courts, and banks reflect the dominant culture. Ditto whose holidays are relegated to an interfaith calendar. Non-Western countries often have calendars that reflect non-Christian observances because European Christian imperialism shapes how we measure time all over the world. This is because Christian imperialism created the West's calendar, which means any country that wants to do business with a Western country has to accommodate the West's calendar.
Or they were forced to accommodate it because they were living under the yoke of imperialism.
Yeah.
Two things are true.
Guns were also involved. Good call. Uh-huh. Okay, fair. Not just pens. The really short version, Ramadan, is definitely on calendars created in Muslim-majority countries, but Christmas is on calendars all over the world, no matter what religion, or lack thereof, in China's case, dominates your country.
In short, the thing we're trying to say is that calendars are not neutral. They can't be. They are about establishing one way of thinking about the world, and that way is rooted in whiteness and Christian imperialism. But even if it wasn't, ordering the world in one way above all others, despite competing ideas, that's never neutral, regardless of who the winner is. So your calendar isn't neutral in the same way that having meetings after business hours isn't neutral, or working through lunch is not a neutral apolitical choice. How we use our time is not neutral. How we order our time is not neutral. And how our time has been ordered for us on a calendar certainly was not and is not neutral. So Megan, what can we do? I think that's our last slide.
Thank you. Ta-da. Okay, well, now that we're all angered up again.
Doesn't take much.
It does not. But I find that when I get all riled up, I settle myself back down by trying to make small but important changes. So maybe we can make some suggestions about what our new Ohio friends can do with all this newfound knowledge. Does that sound okay, new friends?
Yes.
Yes, good.
We appreciate you buying in. We really do record in like these tiny little closets with like soundproofing all over. It's weird to have you here and expect participation. Anyway, keep going. Sorry. Yes, okay. We'll cut that out later. I got excited. I went off script. Go ahead.
Step better process. Sorry. Step one, look at your calendar.
Which holidays does your standard calendar app include? We would bet you $5 that no matter where you're chatting with us or listening to us, that Christmas is on your calendar. Which holidays are missing? You literally might not even know because the information available to you does not list them. And that's okay. We can give you a few to search for. Does your calendar mention Ramadan, Yom Kippur, Diwali? Are there other important religious observances missing? Make some quick notes about what you find. Step two. This is a toughie. Look at some other calendars.
All right. Now that you have looked at the calendar on your phone, check the one for your workplace or your school or your local library. Same questions as above. Who's included? Who's missing? Which is to say, who's marked as important or even really there, worth thinking about, actually existing in your community? As above, we encourage you to start by checking whether your school, your job, whatever, calendar includes significant religious holidays and seasons like Asherah or Rosh Hashanah or...
That was Baisakhi.
I don't know that one. I did an imperialism.
You did. It's fine. Keep going.
Make some quick notes about any significant oversights or omissions. Oh, and then step three. This is my favorite part. Be the problem. Who makes good trouble?
Here's the important but honestly like pretty easy part. And this is your homework, dear listeners and dear nerds in the audience. Pick one. That's one. Calendar from your community that leaves off an important season or holiday from a religious tradition other than your own. And I would encourage you here at Miami to think about what your academic calendar looks like, reflects, whose seasons does it operate under, who has to ask for religious accommodations, and who already gets them. Once you've picked your calendar, write a nice or email. Leave a polite message. That's not a text message, that's a phone message. You have to use your phone, your Square, it calls people. Leave a polite message requesting that the community you're a part of, i.e. Miami University, do one small thing to make space for a different way of being religious. That's it, gang. This might seem like a really small thing to do, and maybe it's too small, but there's no amount of trying to make our communities more inclusive of marginalized folks that's too small to matter.
That's actually the best part. You can do it today. You could do it right now if you want. We won't even be mad at you for looking at your phones. Will your email or your phone call change the whole world? Probably not. Sorry, spoilers. But it might be a first step toward making your Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or otherwise other neighbors feel more at home in your shared community. Haley, what does this look like for you?
Oh, Lord. This looks like the constant reminding of schools that non-Christians are people. And maybe that we could put the holidays that kids and their families might take off, be in houses of worship, or might just not want extras on district-wide calendars. My eldest is in fifth grade. I've got two little kiddos at home, and they're monsters. And they are Jewish monsters, because I'm also a Jewish monster. And they are sad every single year that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are not days off in our district, and often are days that have things like class pictures on them. And it does not matter that from kindergarten through fifth grade, I have yelled at the president of the PTA that we should not have pictures on Yom Kippur. Because that's a double exclusion, right? My kid's not in her class picture because you held the class pictures on the highest holiday for most Jews in America. Woof. And I keep calling about it. But after 6 years of calling about it, they put Yom Kippur on the Board of Ed calendar.
Just a quick, fast 6 years.
And Eid. They did Eid and Yom Kippur together because a coalition of parents kept sending really polite and two really not polite phone calls and emails. I don't know how they picked those holidays over other holidays. It is concerning to me that our district is doing like Yom Kippur, parentheses, observed, because it's over the weekend this year, and Eid, observed, right? So they've made a decision over whose definition of Eid gets to count over someone else's. Mm-hmm. That's a secondary religion issue, and we can talk about that in the Q&A if you like. But the point is that after 6 hard years of labor, we're not going to have that problem anymore. And so is that slow? Absolutely. Is that a slog? You betcha. Did sometimes I want to pull someone's hair out, including my own, but definitely someone else's, like the PTA president's? Yes, you bet your bottom dollar. At the same time, that's different now. And that's a good thing for all of the Jewish and Muslim students in our very small school district.
Yeah, because when things are more fair, we all benefit.
We do.
That's great.
That's how I do it.
Yeah.
Goodwin, what about you? How do you manage calendars in your daily life?
I mean, I don't, A of all, I don't, and you know it, and you're a bitch
social
for
justice.
Asking me that.
In a social justice way. We are at work.
It's too late now. It's on the recording. I mean, I try to be really flexible during times I know students might be fasting or just super busy with religious obligations. I am at a point in my teaching career where I stopped trying to get the university to
recognize this stuff and just made my own class policies because I can't fix the university, but I can make sure I don't give you an exam while you haven't eaten in like 18 hours. That's a thing I can do. I also, at a small liberal arts college, truly before I had even started work, I got an email about the interfaith calendar, and it included a bunch of Baha'i holidays, which is great. That is a valid religion. Those should get celebrated. I was living in rural Maine, Baha'i, a little thin on the ground. And I pointed out that, like, I was glad that these had been included, but, like, holidays that I was likely to celebrate, like, I don't know, like solstices and equinoxes, had been left off, and maybe they could also be put on. And the response I got was, yeah, we don't have space for everybody, which was a choice. And then there were more emails and more phone calls. And then I wound up singing at, like, a multi-faith banquet because once you yell about
a logical conclusion.
Well, if you yell about a thing and they offer to let you make it better, then you have to go make it better.
That's
so
exactly right.
And then sometimes you have to sing, "We also come from the goddess." But whatever. I like, lest you think that we as experts always get this stuff right, I need you to know that this very year, after having written a whole book about how religion shapes the world all around you, and having known that one of Elisa's special interests is religion and calendars, I fully tried to schedule her for a recording on Yom Kippur, which you already heard her say is amongst, if not the most important holiday for American Jews.
Uh-huh, she really did.
I sure did, because I definitely had checked to make sure that Yom Kippur was on my calendar. I had not checked to make sure that the calendar marked it from sundown to sundown, which is technically 2 days on a calendar. I had it on the Monday, I did not have it on the Sunday night. And I realized that, and I apologized, and we fixed it, because when you know better, you do better, but this is an ongoing process, and it is okay to get it wrong as long as you keep trying.
And you don't have to take on the whole world or even your whole state. You can just do what we did. Ask your local community to do a little bit better. And I think that we, you can just bring up your calendars at work. You can be the person who, instead of asking your Hindu coworker when Diwali is, so instead of pawning off your Google ability onto someone else to do the labor for you, you can do it with your handy dandy pocket rectangle. And you can also apologize when things get a little bit crunk.
I myself am frequently crunk. The point is, though, is that it shouldn't always be the obligation of folks who are already marginalized in a country that privileges whiteness and Christianity to advocate for themselves. We're all in the community together, so it is all of our responsibility to make sure that the way that we are telling time isn't, you know, racist and Christian imperialist. All right, so now you know that calendars are political, which means you can start agitating for our calendars to have better politics. So go be a problem who makes good trouble for great justice, and that is your homework. Who has questions?
JJ, are you by chance able to go online? Could you pull up a website on the screen? If you can, go to miamioh.edu/meta, M-E-T-A. One of the organizations that is sponsoring this event is META, which stands for Multi-Faith Engagement for Transformational Action. I forget. It's one of those things where, like, the acronym is cool and we made up something to match it. It's basically an interfaith group on campus. It was formed about a decade ago by faculty, staff, and students who were interested in trying to raise issues of religious diversity on campus. And what I want to take you to, if possible, as part of your homework for today, is a resource that we created in META. It looks like it's coming up now, little by little, having to do particularly with calendars and with understanding what the university's policies are regarding getting time off for students and faculty and staff when it comes to religious holidays. So if you'll go over in the menu, JJ, to where it says religious holidays. So this is on Miami's webpage. There is an interfaith calendar that Academic Affairs has compiled, and so we link to that. So it lists several holidays, although it would be interesting to think about whose holidays end up not being there, right? But which ones are there? You have information there about accommodations. Miami has policies for that, both for students and for faculty and staff. If you are a student, there is a policy at Miami that says that your instructors are supposed to be accommodating when it comes to you taking time off for religious observances. You've got a link to the policy. And you have links there to a system that was created by the Yale University Chaplain's Office for adding religious holidays to your Google calendar. I actually have that synced up with my Miami Google calendar, so I see, again, whichever holidays they decided to include as being there. So some more things you could do by way of homework. Any questions for our podcasters? Raise a hand and we'll bring you a mic.
Oh, we did want to point out that you are being recorded, but that doesn't mean your question has to be recorded. If you'd prefer not to be on the podcast version of this, just let us know and we'll cut you out.
Yep. Consent is important.
It is, in fact, mandatory.
And if you have a different question about religion, that's cool, too.
Or podcasting or public scholarship or being cranky in public.
I'll start with a question.
Please
then,
do.
If
sure.
No one else has one, because I'm going to know about these things.
Oh, great.
Oh, was there a question? Was there a hand?
No, you can go first. It's your event.
All you right, have the mic. Right.
I have the conch. So think about calendars, right?
Yeah.
Violence.
Certainly the way in which we, by which I guess I mean like Americans collectively, measure years has its origin in Christianity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our months are not a Christian invention. They predate Christianity. Mm-hmm. Our days, at least in the English-speaking world, are, again, not a Christian invention. In some parts of Europe, when Christianity arrived, it obliterated the pre-existing names of days, which were often tied to pagan deities. That didn't happen in the English-speaking world. And
nope.
So our days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, are still linked to the names of Germanic deities.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fit into your story?
Because it's a story about power, and Vikings are not currently taking over the world, is the short version. So, yes, if our whole argument was like, the stuff came from religion, that would be one thing. But what we're really asking you to think about is the way that religion operates politically, which is to say where religion exercises power. And I'm being a little flip, but also, seriously, Vikings are not currently taking over the world. Christianity, and specific white Western forms of Christianity, are shaping politics and policies and time all over the world. So that's why we're yelling about that.
I think the days thing for me, it's a great question, John Charles, and I agree with the historical assessment there, right? Like, it's not the same as the year of it all. I think the red letter days for our days, though, are, right? So the moving of Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday as a way to honor a Christian read of that biblical story and also to disambiguate it from the Jews is important. Who has a weekend? Like, what our weekend looks like in this country is Saturday and Sunday, which is in part about like Judeo-Christian normativity, but in Muslim majority countries it's often Friday and Saturday because Fridays observe their Jummah, the Friday major prayer of the week for most Muslims, is a Friday day, not a Saturday or a Sunday day.
Right.
And so even if the days themselves, their naming isn't part of a Christian power moment, the way that we think about the week or the process of days, the beginning of the week, the end of the week, what's a day of rest, what's a day off, is rooted in religious, I don't want to say accommodation, but religious thinking, I would say.
Well, and I think the clearest way to see it for me is where do you have to pick fights to be included, right? Because to observe the Sabbath on Saturday in what's now the United States required a Supreme Court decision, right? Seventh-day Adventists had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to say, I can't work on a Saturday, I need to go to church. In a country that prides itself on religious freedom, in a country that has enshrined free exercise in its founding documents, this woman had to go all the way to the Supreme Court after years of fighting just to observe her religion in the way that her religion had been observed for 100 years, right? That is not equality. Mm-hmm. So we're just asking you to think about who gets left out and how the way that we measure time requires minoritized communities to work just a little bit harder to get things that normies get as a matter of course. Up to and including like requiring you to out yourself as a religious minority in order to get those accommodations.
Yeah.
So at Northeastern, in the state of Massachusetts while I worked there, I am entitled to 2 days, which works out great because everybody only has two holidays, two major holidays every year, right? But to do that, to say, okay, Samhain's an important holiday for me, I'm not going to be in on October 31st, I have to tell the university that I'm a witch and I'm not coming to work that day. I'm calling out witchy. Which in Massachusetts and in a place like Northeastern is probably safe, but who can say? Right, so.
Oh, no, they got Salem right there. Historically questionable.
Yeah, but right now the primary religion of Salem is capitalism. Anyway, I'm just saying, if you don't get to be the default, you have to work a little bit harder and you have to make yourself a lot more vulnerable and from a space that is already vulnerable. And that's what we're encouraging folks to think
about. It's a good question.
It is a great question. Wicked smart.
So I'm a historian who studies religion.
Nerd.
And if I understood your argument in the beginning, that we can't think of religion without thinking about race.
Yes.
But race is a modern concept.
That's true.
And so things that I may study that are not modern and not European may have the category of race doesn't even exist.
It does not.
So
sometimes.
Why do I need to think about it when I'm thinking of, I mean, it's, I can't, there are many contexts in which things that I study, race doesn't play a role at all.
Okay, so from the timeline that we're bringing you, right, we're suggesting the construction of whiteness and blackness and nativeness happens out of Western European Christianity and colonization, right? So just to clarify, because this is a weird concept if you don't study race, the way that we understand whiteness doesn't really emerge until, like, let's call it the 17th century in what's now the United States. So on the one hand, Hundo P, right? If we're talking about second century BCE, the concept of whiteness does not exist. Here's the thing. People use history a lot. People go back to those times and say, these are the origins of our civilization, and they map contemporary understandings of race back onto contexts where this would not have been an operating concept. We need to look at the way that the past gets used, right? We have had violent fights in the last 5 years about thinking about race in medieval European contexts. Race does not exist in the same way, but white nationalists sure are trying to use it in ways that the people in the we won't call them the Dark Ages, the Bright Ages, it wouldn't have been familiar to them, but people are looking for usable pasts with these contemporary concepts. So that is one reason I think you need to care about it.
I'll let that go. That's fine.
Hi, thank you for coming here today. I have a question about, in some regards, if we're truly valuing religion and calendars entirely anymore, and that I think there's being a shift in secular thought to being more focused on business, not to say that the past is gone per se, but things are changing. For example, we just came back from spring break, and I think it's worth noting that the majority of Christians celebrated Easter yesterday. I'm excluding Orthodox
anyway.
Easter, which is another month off. The Sunday before coming back from break is often a time where a lot of people need to do homework and do a lot of traveling. So in some regards, we're seeing a prioritization of setting a sort of end of March, mid-March, in the spring break calendar that's not accommodating to even the majority religion. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that balancing work and life is really hard. And so needing to balance Easter Sunday with travel and homework is hard. And I think that as like a Jewish lady, I want to say two things. The first is welcome to the club. And I say that with full-blown snark because like I also teach at a public university and I never get the option. It's not an option. And so the idea of like having to rush around and manage all the things and you want to celebrate your holiday, but you also want to see your grandma, but you also have to do your homework and there's also a paper to, right? Like, yes. Welcome to what the minority feels like. And if it was an off year for you, like I assume that Miami U does what we do at University of Vermont, which is the academic calendar always has spring break on the same week of the year, and then Easter kind of floats around the calendar. It's not a set day, right? It's not December 25 or March 1, right? And so this year was a fluky year where it lined up and felt kind of yucky. And so I kind of want to say, yeah, solidarity, sister. Like, that is how everyone that's not Christian feels all the rest of the time. Because I want to say the other thing is, you still had a Sunday.
Yeah.
You could have planned your break differently to do your homework on Friday when you didn't have, or Good Friday, but you could have done your homework on Thursday. Or you could have.
Thursday?
Listen.
There were pancakes involved. There was no time.
Regardless, you could do your homework differently. You can think about it differently. You still have Sunday to celebrate Easter with your family. And so that's, I think, still a luxury. I think the flip of it is what solidarities does that create for you with other religions on campus? Do you want to agitate so that at Miami, they do not schedule spring break in such a way, or they give you Easter Monday off, right? Like, I grew up in New Jersey. There were our entire neighborhood was Catholic. And so Easter Monday was always a thing for precisely this reason, so that you could travel or have your big banquet and everyone could clean up. Right? You could like stay late at grandma's house. And so what solidarities does this create for you? Does that create empathy for you, or does it create bitterness? How dare they do this to me? Instead of, man, our Muslim colleagues are fasting sun up to sundown, and the religious, I bet, I'm curious actually, this is a question for y'all, but I bet that your religious holidays accommodations does not know what to do with a month-long sustained holiday that is not a one-off and that is not a we don't have to go to school. Because my university doesn't, and every university I've ever taught at doesn't. And so I would urge you to say, this was crappy, and I really want to make this better for all of us, while I'm also going to push back a little and say, yeah, that was your experience this year, and it was still a weekend.
Also, sorry, but not sorry. You use the word secular, and I think a lot of times we assume secular equals not religious. Max Weber would encourage us to think about that a little bit harder.
Oh, not Weber.
Yes, Weber. Always Weber.
How about Talal Asad?
Also
a better citation.
It can be both. But I'm specifically doing a critique of capitalism, so stick with me.
Fair enough.
What had happened was the university and capitalism in general has made your religion and your religious practice your private business.
Yeah.
Right? It's no longer protected by the state in exactly the same ways. At the same time, assumptions about which time is off and which time is on get maintained. Those assumptions about which time is off still rooted in Christianity, but not in your face, right? Secularism forces us to think about the ways that some religious assumptions, white Protestant assumptions, have been internalized to the extent that we don't even recognize them as necessarily religious anymore. Every single one of you gets Sunday off from school, regardless of how you feel about Jesus. Yes? Yes, that is true, right? The fact that it was a special Sunday this week, not only because Easter, but also because Trans Day of Visibility, does not matter to the university. It certainly does not matter to banks, but you have every Sunday off, whether you care about Jesus or not, because of Jesus. So it's just, it is tricky, and I think
sticky. It's tricky and sticky.
And it's hard. It's hard to feel left out. It's hard when your community doesn't value the things that are important to you.
It's also hard to make the choice between all of the things you want to do that are correct, right? It is correct to do your homework. It is correct to travel at a safe and timely way. It is correct to want to be with your family on a holiday. It is also, right? Like, all of those are competing correct choices. That's really hard.
That's hard. It's tricky. So, takeaway, fair enough, / you still get every Sunday off, / how can we work to make sure that more folks feel included and seen and have space to celebrate without having to further marginalize themselves?
Or without having to choose between homework or grandma. I'm making it about grandma's, like, grandma house is where my holidays happen, but you know, I mean, like, whoever you go hang out with. I think Professor Hotham has a question.
Hi, Professor
hey,
Hotham.
Good to see you all. So I think it can be hard. We've been circling around this. It can be hard for people to see the relationship between religion, race, and calendars in their own place because it's the water we swim in.
Mm-hmm.
And it can also be hard to see this as being like an intentional association, right? But it is true that there are times and places where people definitely see these things as interrelated and make changes accordingly. So I wonder if you might give us some examples, I don't mean to put you on the spot, of times and places where the relationship between religion, race, and calendar has been super explicit in, say, like a national project, like maybe in Iran, for example.
Oh, I wasn't going
to. Or wherever else you want to go.
I wasn't. That should be the wheelhouse. I was going to go with, in Vermont, we switched from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm. It had been an argument of our local Indigenous community, the Abenaki, for many years that we did not want to celebrate Columbus Day.
Because of all the murder.
The murder and the raping and the pillaging. Yeah. Like, what if that's not it? And after loads, like many, many years of arguing, it flipped. So Columbus Day is no longer on the calendar in Vermont. It has been replaced by Indigenous Peoples Day explicitly in the writ that Governor Phil Scott signed. It makes the claim that it gives the history of Columbus Day and how Columbus was being, was a champion, was the Italian American community saw Columbus as a way to Americanize and fit into mainstream understandings of whiteness and claim that if the District of Columbia is named after Columbus, then surely we have a right to be here in a moment when anti-Italian and anti-Catholic sentiment was super, super high.
So like early 20th century.
Early 20th century when the holiday becomes national. And then it gives the history of Columbus Day, and then the rest of the like writ that was passed talks about why Indigenous Peoples Day needs to replace it, because that concern is no longer the concern of Vermont, but the ongoing marginalization and genocide of Abenaki folk in Vermont makes us want to celebrate Indigenous people over and above the main murderer of Indigenous people. And so that for me is race, religion, and calendars right in the thing. And I was really shocked, I'll be honest, shocked by the way that the Phil Scott government handled it. A lot of folks, Phil Scott's a Republican in a very liberal, like we're like Bernie country, you know what I mean? Like we have a very liberal reputation, but our state politics are actually quite conservative for us and on other issues. And like we're an open carry gun state, you know what I mean? Like we can't be that lefty if that's what you're doing. But there's this space in which Phil Scott really took a lot of flack from quite a lot of big Republican donors in the state and made it really explicit that this was a racist project and that the racialization of Native Americans was at this moment in history a bigger wrong for Vermont to right than this national adoption of Columbus Day, which doesn't affect Vermont in the same way as other states. We don't have a huge Italian history. We don't have a huge Italian American population.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, Phil Scott is laying out, one, that the celebration of Columbus Day was part of a campaign to include Italians in the American project, which is to say, to whiten up American Italians.
Yeah, he acknowledges in this, I mean, it's Vermont has weird politics. It's like a writ. Says that we understand the racist history of why Columbus Day needed to exist.
Right.
We are now also acknowledging the racist history of why that's a problem.
Yes. I also feel like it's important to note that there were a lot of projects about strengthening the whiteness of Italians in the early 20th century by specifically celebrating doers of genocide, right? So the religious history that's happening here is the reason we have a Columbus is because the Pope gave the whole world to Spain and Portugal and said, these lands don't belong to anybody. There's people there, but don't worry about them. They're not real people. And eventually they'll die off anyway. So what I hear Phil Scott celebrating is actually the persistence, the thriving of Native people as the priority of the state of Vermont.
Yeah.
Which is a really different project.
And on the first Indigenous Peoples Day, to tie it back to religion, the University of Vermont was really active in the eugenics movement in the 1920s. We did quite a lot of experiments in our biology, psychology, and budding, it was called the eugenics department, Jesus. But our like budding genetics program, where there were over 150 sterilized Native Americans. There were over 200 sterilized people deemed mentally unfit. And we can do a separate history on disability politics and all of that.
Yeah.
And quite a lot, I don't know the numbers, of African Americans in Vermont. And so Vermont, the University of Vermont was absolutely integral to the work that was done in violating Native peoples, among others. And the university, when Indigenous Peoples Day was announced by the state, right, we're a state school with a flagship school, hosted the Abenaki community to resacralize the land that UVM was on. And it was tied explicitly to the acceptance of the calendar. And hilariously, the university refused to make, to make Indigenous Peoples Day part of our academic calendar. So it's not a day off, even though the state government is closed. It is instead what's known as an instructional day, where everyone meets for class regularly, but there's a big lecture about Native Americans. So I want you to hear my snark. I don't think we handle it well, even if there has been some margin, like the multiplicity of calendars doing the labor are never singular.
And now you have another thing you can call about. That's great. You needed more work.
I always need more work.
Hi.
Hi.
Earlier you said that universities don't really know how to navigate like month-long holidays. And then on the flip side, we can't, well, I shouldn't say we can't, but I feel like it's unfair to shift the burden onto minorities to advocate for themselves.
Totally.
So, but obviously like me as a white person doesn't understand another person's experiences. So how do you think we should go about that?
It's a fantastic question. Do you want to take this one?
Well, let's start with oppression isn't about feelings, right? Like, no, if you did not grow up Muslim, if you are not a convert to Islam, you don't know what it feels like to be Muslim. I bet you know what it feels like to be hungry, though. Are you doing your best thinking when you're hungry? No. So if anybody on your campus is fasting for Ramadan, you know that they are not doing their best thinking. And you could point out to the administration, hey, the way that we think about holidays does not include everybody on this campus. Is it possible to do something differently? It is a university, so the first 17 times they're going to say, no, we've always done it this way, and go away and leave us alone, and you're just being...
Or they'll give you the list of admin that you need to talk
yes.
to. Like at our campus, it's always like, talk to the head of dining services.
And get that form filled out, but you can't get the form filled out until you get it signed, but you can't get it signed until you get the form. You got to be a nudge. But the other thing that I think maybe college students don't know is how much power you have on campuses.
Oh my God, so much power.
They are scared of you in a way that they are not scared of us.
Not even a little.
We have zero power because we need them for paychecks. You are paying them to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You will never have more power over an institution than you have right now. So if this is a thing that you care about, go bother them.
Yeah, but don't incite a riot, Megan.
I didn't incite a riot. I incited a calm and conscientious letter-writing campaign.
We're just doing this for legalities. Do whatever you want. I completely agree with everything that my good colleague here has said. But I think also another thing you can do is like show up at your Muslim Student Association, right? Like send their, I don't know how it works here at our university. All of the leadership of all of the student clubs have little websites and they have to be listed through the Student Government Association. So maybe that's not your gag, but at my university, what I literally just advised our, I advised many student groups. And one of the student groups was like, how can we be in solidarity with this Ramadan thing? Because there was a big kerfuffle, an orgo exam happened and they would not schedule a makeup and it is in direct violation of the religious holidays policy, except the religious holidays policy assumes a day off. It does not assume I'm just thirsty, right? And so there's a loophole in the policy. So two things happened. Faculty like me, who have to serve on faculty senate positions, which is boring as hell, sent a letter to the Student Affairs Committee and was like, hey, 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 it's me again, your favorite pain in the ass. And I need us to revisit the religious holidays policy. The second thing I told students to do, that was a faculty job. What I told students to do was, email the vice president, email the president of your MSA and say, hey, I've noticed that this is a problem. I would like to take on a project, not teach me about Ramadan, because you can Google that for real. But I would like to take on a project. I find that this is really deeply unfair. Could I come and listen to you tell me about how hard it is on for campus on for you or how great it is? Maybe it's awesome and you just don't know. But asking that question and then forming a set of options in conversation with Muslims, because in this case we're talking about Muslims, but this could be anybody, is the way that I usually advise students to do it. Listen first, ask more questions, and then create a plan together. Because actually, when someone names the problem, they become the problem. And I'm citing Sarah Ahmed here. So we don't want Muslim students to have to go knock on the provost's door when, and then Muslimness becomes a problem. That's already kind of crappy, right? Does that help?
I just want to underscore what Elise said, because I think it's really important. I think if you are the sort of person, I am the sort of person, who wants to make things better and who has the energy to go make good trouble, it can be really tempting to just like rush in and be like, I know what this, like, I know what's needed. As a white lady, it is really important that I don't show up and start telling marginalized communities what they need. Building relationships, learning from folks who are already doing this work, and then asking how you can be of help, how you can be of service, how you can use your white ladiness, because goddamn is that powerful. If you show up and cry someplace, my Lord.
Oh my God, don't encourage white tears.
Only for great justice. I'm just saying. I think it is okay to weaponize.
Go ahead. Yeah, weaponize it.
White lady tears. If you're doing it on behalf of communities that are telling you, like, this is a thing that you can help with, right? So, yeah, building relationships, listening first, and then using what you got.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you very much for coming. And I really understood the argument as a Jewish student growing up through, you know, the American school system. Hanukkah was during finals week last year, which was always fun. Traveling home for spring break during a fast day, always enjoyable.
Just like the entire month of September, right? It's great.
So it's October.
That's actually where my question is going with the high holidays. So I come from the Chicago suburbs where there's a sizable Jewish population. And the high school where my synagogue used to host services, because they have a large Jewish population, they already had Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur off, and the school was already shut down. So my question is, and this kind of goes to your point about putting every religion on the calendar, the choices there, and also kind of making religion a private matter as opposed to a public issue like they do in France. So my question is, in your opinion, is it better than to innately have the system inherently accommodate those majority or plurality religions, or is it better to just say blanket statement, everyone has to be asked for those accommodations and be accommodated because religion is a private matter, or is it better just to give the big religions off and have the small religions accommodate, or where do you see that fitting in?
Yeah, fix religious freedom real quick. Go, ready to go.
Yeah, sure, no problem. That was a joking. I can't fix religious freedom in 5 minutes in Ohio. So two things. I think it's actually a matter of what institution we're talking about. I'm not mad. So, like, I grew up in the New York metro area where there's, like, a gajillion Jews, and the Jewish teachers' unions are actually the reason that the schools I grew up in and that my mother taught in and that my siblings went to school in did not have the high holidays in school, right? Because if you had enough teachers calling out, it's a capitalist issue. You cannot field that many subs in a day. It wasn't for the practitioners. It was for the issue of having to pay substitutes on those days. That's the history of that there. So, like, I'm of two minds. I'm not mad that a K-12 system does not have every single religious holiday off when its school population might not reflect those things. I mind a lot when parents are like, hey, but this affects me, and I am in this community, and you're still booking the school pictures on that day, right? Like, those are two separate but related issues. We live in rural Vermont. There's not a lot of Jewish people in a state that has like six people soaking wet. So I don't expect the school to have off for Yom Kippur, but I do expect Yom Kippur to be honored. And so for a while, I had been arguing that religious holidays be counted separately in absences, because it pisses me off a lot that in a state that penalizes truancy, my kids get absent days for high holiday observance that can and does, especially as they get older, count against their GPA, counts against their eligibility for graduation, right? So there are level. What I'm trying to say in an inelegant way is that there are levels of accommodation, and it doesn't mean all or nothing. It doesn't mean every religious holiday that you could possibly think of is a day off for everybody. It can mean, what does it look like? How are we counting absences? How are we thinking about sick days? Do employees of that university or that school have, whether it's perfect or not, have the ability to say, I'm taking a religious holiday day today?
I think if we were going to argue about France and secularism, which is like a whole other can of worms, you'd have to then say, but do we still have Christmas off? To me, if the nation is closed for Christmas, there is no universe in which it is equal. I don't need Christmas off. I have never needed Christmas off. I'd be super happy to work on that day because I don't need it off. I need Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah off, and I wouldn't mind having the first day of Passover off so I can, like, kosher my kitchen and cook, right? I wouldn't mind that. I do not need Christmas. If the global majority or the nation's majority are thinking about, and I don't mean numbers-wise, I mean power-wise, if they are thinking about wanting it to be equal across, then Christmas is a work day. It is a work day, and you are taking that as a flex day off. That's what equality looks like to me, or equity looks like to me. It doesn't look like everybody gets no days on, and so now between every single religion that you could possibly name, no one's ever in school. It looks like, how do we accommodate this multicultural space that we all inhabit? And I think at a university it's actually more important because you're not drawing from a local community. Miami University is a global university, am I right? That means admissions-wise, you are trying to represent everybody here. If that is a stated goal of your university, to welcome everybody here, accept everybody's tuition dollars here, and then to tell some people, actually, you're not super welcome here, that is like dereliction of duty to me. Does that make sense? Did I answer your question?
If I may ask a follow-up.
Sure. Can you speak into the mic? Wait for Professor Duffy.
If I may ask a follow-up, so you brought up the example of kind of yearbook photos on Yom Kippur before, and my sister's actually in a similar situation right now, where one of her high school ceremonies is the first night of Pesach. I'm talking about this with my sister, and from my perspective, it's better to miss the ceremony to go to Passover. She takes the other stance of, if I don't go to the ceremony, I miss that. There's two nights of Passover. And so my question is, in the yearbook example, in this example I just provided, who does the burden lay upon? Is it on the burden of the school then to change the day of yearbook photos or the ceremony? Or does it lay on the burden of the religious person and say, oh, well, you just have to miss it? Who does the burden lay on, in your opinion?
So I think that's a really interesting question. For me, because I care about equity and inclusion, the burden is on the school. Yeah. You should have the ability to opt in and not have to opt out. Secular Christians do not have to decide whether opening presents that Santa brought to a Christmas tree, right? They ain't got nothing to do with Jesus. They don't have to decide if they need to choose in or choose out because the government is closed. Most businesses are closed. They're not put in that position to make that hard decision. Or, like our question from the back, it's rare to have to make that decision. You had the choice of celebrating Easter or getting home on time, right? So to me, the burden is on the school completely. Theologically, I can see the argument. There's a lot of minoritized religions, especially in the United States, that make the argument that, like, this is a test of your faith. How well can you perform Ramadan under the burden of living in an American milieu? I don't really care about the theological question, though, because that's like a private, that is actually to me a private question between you and your religious community. As a scholar of religion, I care about the space of studying religion from a bird's eye view or historical view. And when we ask Jewish students to make a choice that we have never asked Christian students to make, we are inherently talking about an inequitable situation, at which point a public school should absolutely be fixing that.
Yeah.
That's not the point of public school.
Our tech expert needs to go to another event, so let's wrap up. One last plug, though. I believe the information you guys presented tonight is from your upcoming book, yes?
It is. Religion is Not Done With You, forthcoming from Beacon Press, November 2024, inshallah.
All righty. Thank you. One more round of applause for our presenters.
And can we just say one more time, thank you for being here. We know it's like Storm City and that some of you are held here captive by teachers that you, but we appreciate it, hostages or not. So thank you so much for being here and for having us.
And second thanks to all of the folks who made this possible, Liz, John, Charles, JJ, everybody, thank you so much and thank you for being here and do your homework, it's on the syllabus.
Peace out, nerds.
Thank you. Thank you.